Welcome to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm your volunteer reader, Neil Kelly. In this hour, we will be reading headlines from the Valley and the State and USA Today. Our first local news story is titled, Do You Live in a Boring City? Two Arizona cities ranked among dullest in the United States. By Olivia Rose, Arizona Republic. From popular sporting events to critically acclaimed restaurants, to gorgeous hiking trails for all abilities, Phoenix truly offers something for everyone. As the fifth largest city in the United States, and still growing, Phoenix is clearly a hotspot, pun intended. So why did a recent study called Bored in the USA, conducted by financial publication Finance Buzz, rank Phoenix among the top 10 most boring cities in the country? Is it because outsiders think we just sit inside all summer? Actually, Finance Buzz didn't even take the scorching temperatures into account when giving Phoenix its disheartening rating. The real reasons for Phoenix's low score, though, might surprise you. Is Phoenix a boring city? No, of course not, and anyone at the Arizona Republic will tell you that. There's no shortage of things to do and quirks that make our capital city unique. Regardless, Finance Buzz ranked Phoenix as the 10th most boring out of the 75 biggest cities in America. Ouch! The reasons behind the disappointing ranking: there are 1.7 concert venues available for every 100,000 people, the third lowest rate in the country. Additionally, Phoenix has the sixth lowest rate of annual celebrations and events per capita in the country, according to Finance Buzz. Tucson ranked among most boring cities. The second largest city in Arizona was ranked number 17 on Finance Buzz's list. While a detailed explanation for this was not provided, Tucson received a score of 23.5 out of 100. Finance Buzz said a lower score means the city is more boring. For comparison, the most exciting city received a total score of 72.7, and Phoenix scored 20.5. How did the study pick up the most boring cities? According to Finance Buzz, data for five major categories related to fun and excitement were collected for each city using various sources, including the Census Bureau and Yellow Pages. Population makeup. Percent of the population aged 65 and older, percent aged 20 to 34 years old, number of international visitors per capita. Culinary scene. Number of Yelp's top 100 restaurants in the country, number of Michelin-honored restaurants per capita, number of James Beard-honored restaurants per capita, percent of restaurants that are chains. Outdoor activities. Parks, climate, number of hiking trails per capita, and walkability. Nightlife and celebrations. Number of nightclubs, concert venues, annual celebrations, and events per capita. Things to do. Number of sports teams, number of amusement places and arcades per capita, number of travelers' choice attractions per capita. The top 20 most boring cities in America: Jacksonville, Florida; Wichita, Kansas; Corpus Christi, Texas; Sioux Falls, South Dakota; Memphis, Tennessee; San Antonio; Oklahoma City; Columbus, Ohio; Tallahassee, Florida; Phoenix; Albuquerque, New Mexico; Louisville, Kentucky; Lexington, Kentucky; Colorado Springs, Colorado; Tulsa, Oklahoma; Indianapolis; Tucson; Houston; Virginia Beach; and Charlotte, North Carolina. The top 20 most exciting cities in the United States: Atlanta, Miami, St. Louis, Orlando, Florida, New York, Washington, D.C., Minneapolis, Las Vegas, Salt Lake City, San Francisco, Pittsburgh, Seattle, Cincinnati, Boston, New Orleans, Chicago, Denver, Honolulu, Los Angeles, and Tampa, Florida. The next article is titled, Scottsdale Quarter Sold for $645 Million, One of Arizona's Biggest Ever Deals, by Karina Vanek and Catherine Rieger, Arizona Republic. One of Scottsdale's most popular shopping centers sold for $645.1 million in one of the priciest real estate deals in Arizona history. The Scottsdale Quarter sold to a tech billionaire who plans to invest another $100 million revamping it. Falcon Eye Ventures, a firm founded by George Kurtz, CEO of CrowdStrike, bought the center, located near Kierland Commons Shopping Center and the nearby Kierland Resort. Columbus, Ohio-based SDQ Fee LLC sold it, according to public records. It follows a string of recent big deals around the valley. In May, the JW Marriott Phoenix Desert Ridge Resort and Spa sold for $865 million. Last year, the Arizona Biltmore sold for $705 million. Who's the new owner of Scottsdale Quarter, and why did they buy it? Scottsdale Quarter is a powerful asset with even greater future potential as a magnet retail destination and a hub for breakthrough technology companies, Kurtz said in a statement, adding he envisions catalysts for innovative companies and economic growth. Phoenix-based Vestar, the owner and operator of many other Phoenix-area shopping centers, including Desert Ridge Marketplace and Tempe Marketplace, will partner with Falcon Eye and oversee operations of the property. David Larcher, CEO of Vestar, said his company has had a long relationship with Falcon Eye, which owns the Scottsdale Promenade, which Vestar operates. "We brought this opportunity to them near the end of last year," Larcher said of the purchase of Scottsdale Quarter. "We watched the evolution of this project since it was initially developed in the mid-2000s, and we thought this was an opportunity to bring Scottsdale Quarter to the next level." "There is very little vacancy at the shopping center now," Larcher said, "but as tenant leases expire, Vestar will look to replace them with new businesses that will keep the center fresh and on trend." What is Scottsdale Quarter? Scottsdale Quarter is a mixed-use center of shops, restaurants, condos, and offices at Butherus Drive and Scottsdale Road. The 755,000-square-foot open-air property includes nearly 600 residential units and 300,000 square feet of office space, according to CoStar. The center is home to more than 100 restaurants and shops. They include Sephora, Lululemon, and Restoration Hardware, and restaurants Dominic's Steakhouse and Eddie V's Prime Seafood. The quad area has the largest pop jet fountain in the region. What changes are coming to Scottsdale Quarter? The new owners of Scottsdale Quarter have big plans for their investment. Last week, they announced details of $100 million in improvements. "We want to attract brands and shoppers who see the uniqueness, craftsmanship, and cultural relevance," Larcher said. "We want it to be a fashion-forward destination similar to the iconic retail streets around the country." Larcher said he would like Scottsdale Quarter to be on the same level as Soho in New York City or the Miami Design District in Miami. The company will seek out chef-driven restaurants and contemporary luxury retail tenants to fill vacancies. The company will also improve infrastructure, catch up with maintenance, renovate common areas, and landscaping. Offices will get a makeover too, with a new conference center, fitness room, and other amenities, Larcher said. What else has CrowdStrike CEO George Kurtz developed in Scottsdale? Kurtz is also the developer of the nearby Parquet project, which is about a half mile north of Scottsdale Quarter at the site of the shuttered Cracker Jack's theme park. That project, which will cost about $1 billion to develop, was approved by the Scottsdale City Council in 2023. The first phase has been submitted to the city for development review and is planned to include four restaurant buildings, a 70-unit condominium development, and an 89-unit mixed-use apartment building. At full build-out, the site will have about 2 million square feet of buildings. In total, the site will have about 897 apartment units, 98 workforce housing units, 115 traditional condo units, and 126 condo units that will be branded with a five-star hotel. Plans also call for a 223-room five-star hotel and 100,000 square feet of office space. The next article is titled, "Homicidal Violence Caused Emily Pike's Death, Medical Examiner Says," by Elena Santa Cruz, Arizona Republic. Emily Pike's cause of death was homicidal violence with blunt head trauma, according to the Pinal County Medical Examiner's Office. The 14-year-old San Carlos Apache girl was found dismembered in February, nearly 100 miles from where she had been living in a Mesa group home. Her body was found about 3 weeks after she was reported missing. Though her death was ruled a homicide, the medical examiner's report was on hold, according to a spokesperson for the medical examiner's office. They said the office was waiting to hear from law enforcement and attorneys as to when it could be released. No one has been arrested or named as a suspect in the investigation, which is being led by the Gila County Sheriff's Office. There is also a multi-agency task force comprised of the Gila County Sheriff's Office, the FBI, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the San Carlos Apache Police Department, and Mesa Police that is working to help find Emily's killer. On June 29th, Silent Witness announced that the reward for information leading to an arrest has been increased from $2,000 to $27,000 due to additional funds provided by the Arizona Department of Public Safety. People can contact Silent Witness at 480-WITNESS or 480-TESTIGO for Spanish speakers, or submit a tip online at silentwitness.org. The San Carlos Apache Tribe is also offering a $75,000 reward for information leading to an arrest in the case. An April investigation by the Arizona Republic found that more than a year before her death, Emily was sexually assaulted by a relative on the reservation. For unknown reasons, the case was handled by the Tribal Game and Fish Department, not the tribe's police department. Her alleged assailant was taken into custody, but tribal prosecutors dropped the case. The sexual assault and its aftermath helped explain Emily's transformation from a bright, smiling girl to a reserved and self-destructive teen who relatives said they didn't recognize. Emily was a frequent runaway. She attempted suicide before, and after tribal social services removed her from her mother's custody on the reservation and placed her in the group home. But she got homesick for friends and family on the San Carlos Apache Reservation. She left the group home by slipping out her bedroom window, the group home manager told the Republic. Emily was last seen on January 27th. On February 14th, Emily's remains were found in a pair of trash bags on a berm off Highway 60 at milepost 277. Her torso and head were found in one bag, and her legs in another. Her hands and arms were missing. The bags were dumped about 27 miles north of Globe and about 50 miles from her family's home. Our next article is titled, "These Five New Arizona Laws Will Affect Your Life. Here's What They Do," by Mary Jo Pitzel and Stacy Barchenger, Arizona Republic. Sometimes it's hard to connect the dots in state legislation with daily life. For example, a bill that sets the stage to allow agriculture land and its water rights to be converted to housing is a pretty big deal, but its impact is likely years away as officials sort through the intricacies of how to make that plan work. Important pieces of legislation often address policy and statutory language that can be hard to untangle. But amid the hundreds of bills that made it through the process and were signed into law by Governor Katie Hobbs, there are numerous examples of changes that can make a difference in an average Arizonan's daily life. Here are a few examples of such bills. They take effect September 26, unless otherwise noted. Legal age to buy tobacco increases. Starting this fall, the legal age to buy tobacco and vaping products in Arizona increases to 21, up from the current 18 years. Senate Bill 1247 brings Arizona into compliance with a 2019 federal law that made 21 the legal age for tobacco purchases. But many retailers either ignored the law or didn't check a purchaser's age. The law got tougher last fall when the federal Tobacco 21 law required retailers to verify the age of any buyer under age 30 by checking a driver's license or other document. The bill sponsored by Senator David Farnsworth, Republican of Mesa, applies to vaping products as well as paraphernalia products such as hookahs or water pipes. There is one exception. Members of the military are exempt from the age 21 limit. Whiskey on the water. Boats or docks that have a liquor license no longer will have to link liquor sales to food sales under the terms of a new law, and those sales can continue until 11 p.m. rather than the 5 p.m. cutoff time in current law. For expanded marine adventures, thank Senator T.J. Shope, the sponsor of Senate Bill 1467. We have an opportunity here, I think, to add another layer of fun, whatever you do to define it as, on water, Shope said, when he introduced the bill. It's an attempt to replicate the festive mood found in Old Town Scottsdale and downtown Phoenix when people take to the streets on party bikes, he said. Porn sites and age checks. Porn sites will have to verify the age of any user before granting access, a law that is intended to protect children. House Bill 2112, sponsored by Representative Nick Cupper, Republican of Surprise, outlines penalties ranging from $10,000 a day to a fine of $250,000 if a minor accesses a website that displays pornography. The law, which will take effect September 26, also prevents site operators from storing or sharing age verification information. It passed with strong bipartisan support. Public alerts for vulnerable populations. Lawmakers expanded the network of public alerts sent via text and radio broadcast for people who have gone missing to include those with cognitive disabilities, as well as Native Americans. Building on the Silver Alert model, which notifies the public of a missing senior citizen, House Bill 2894 will extend the system. The bill renames the alert program the Seek and Find Alert System. The legislation, sponsored by Representative Keel Powell, Republican of Gilbert, also requires immediate action by law enforcement upon learning of a missing person. There have been cases when law enforcement has waited to issue alerts due to bureaucratic moves, according to Powell. Lawmakers also established the Turquoise Alert, which is tailored to provide quick notification of Indigenous individuals ages 18 to 64. Those 65 and older are covered by the Seek and Find system. Representative Therese Martinez, Republican of Casa Grande, sponsored House Bill 2281 and stipulated that it be called Emily's Law. That recognizes Emily Pike, a San Carlos Apache teenager who went missing from her Mesa Group home and was later found dismembered. Adding 9/11 to the curriculum. Junior high and high school students who return to the classroom in the fall will get age-appropriate instruction on the 9/11 terrorist attacks, a world-shaking event that happened before any of them were born. Legislation sponsored by Senator J.D. Mesnard, Republican of Chandler, modifies an existing law that designates September 11th as 9/11 Education Day. It requires instruction that is appropriate for the student's age. Senate Bill 1225 was passed with an emergency clause, which means it took effect as soon as Governor Katie Hobbs signed it, which she did on March 19th. Next, we have an article titled, Will Israel-Iran War Weather Affect Gas Prices in Arizona? Here's What to Expect, by Sasha Hupka, Arizona Republic. Arizona motorists are seeing a relatively cheap summer at the gas pump, despite recent conflicts abroad. Oil prices have fluctuated since the start of the Israel-Iran war earlier this month, but gas prices have remained relatively steady across the nation and have largely declined in Arizona, according to data from the American Automobile Association. Experts say that's because the oil markets have generally seen a stable year, with global supplies mostly matching demand. The market spiked slightly when Israel attacked several nuclear and military locations in Iran and rose again after the United States got involved in the conflict. But a ceasefire deal now appears to be holding. In recent days, oil markets have cooled significantly. Julian Paredes of AAA said the markets rose on fear of a wider protracted conflict rather than any actual damage to oil infrastructure. The industry is future-looking, but the ceasefire agreement appears to have alleviated some of those worries. This still has been a mostly stable year for the oil industry, and that's good for gas prices, Paredes said. It's not to say gas prices won't go up this summer, for one reason or another, but there's little reason to panic about prices spiking as long as tensions calm down. Some experts worry about a worst-case scenario in which Iran could attempt to close the Straits of Hormuz. The narrow channel provides the only sea passage from the Persian Gulf to the open ocean and is a critical oil checkpoint, a choke point. About a fifth of the world's petroleum travels through the straits each year, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. But Kanan Ramaswamy, a professor at Arizona State University who studies the oil industry, said it is somewhat unlikely that Iran takes that step. Closing the straits will be a showstopper for them, he said, noting that the country is highly dependent on oil and gas exports for its own revenues. If it did, oil prices would climb globally until alternative routes were established. But Ramaswamy said the U.S. gets most of its crude oil from elsewhere and is sitting on a healthy strategic oil reserve that could help mute supply impacts. We are not facing supply shortfalls at the moment, he said. I don't mean to minimize the global implications of the strikes, but dislocations will be transient at best. What else might affect gas prices? Weather events, seasonal changes, and inflation may also impact what motorists pay at the pump. Gas prices in Arizona generally tend to be higher than the national average. That's because the state produces hardly any crude oil, and no significant refineries operate here. Those factors often elevate fuel prices locally. That's especially true in the summer, when gas is typically at its most expensive because of higher demand and a switch to a costlier summer fuel blend. Prices tend to peak around June and July, and then start dropping as summer winds down. Paredes said he is keeping an eye on hurricane season, which can threaten oil refineries in areas along the Gulf of Mexico. That's especially notable for Tucson, which largely relies on refineries in Texas for fuel. So far, meteorologists are tracking just one tropical storm in the Atlantic Ocean. It is widely expected to remain far away from any land, but tropical researchers anticipate that the overall season will be busy and dangerous. Maintenance on oil refineries could also bump up gas prices, but that isn't expected until the fall or spring. Paredes said it's common for motorists to see temporary spikes in late August and September as facilities go offline for scheduled servicing. Generally, refineries avoid maintenance during summer because demand for gas is high, he said. it would take some emergency for a refinery to shut down in the immediate future. Phoenix gets its gas from refineries in California. Prices are expected to jump soon there because of a state sales tax hike and stricter rules on refineries to encourage the production of lower carbon fuels. Estimates vary widely on how much more Californians might pay for gas once the changes take effect. Arizona's gas prices remain low comparable to prior summers, so the state appears to have plenty of room to absorb any impacts from the new refinery regulations without causing sticker shock at the pump. Ramaswamy said the most immediate risk to gas prices is inflation. He said the two tend to travel together, and noted consumer prices have jumped in recent months. President Donald Trump's on-again, off-again tariffs have fanned moderate inflation, and some economists fear more widespread price increases may still lie ahead. Should gas prices go up, the effect of those increases will be magnified, Ramaswamy said. This is primarily because oil and gas supplies are the primary energy source and therefore connected to everything we consume as a society. For now, gas prices in the desert remain low compared to prior summers. Analysts generally expect that trend to continue. Wars and severe weather are the biggest factors that could drive up gas prices in the near future. But there's no way of predicting that, Paredes said. The next article is titled, Evacuations Underway for Navajo Community Members Living Near Oak Ridge Fire, by Arlissa D. Bicente, Arizona Republic. As of the evening of June 30th, the Navajo community of St. Michael's was placed on SET status due to increasing winds fueling the Oak Ridge Fire, which had grown to 6,545 acres with zero containment. Evacuations were ordered for people living in the Navajo communities of Hunters Point and the Oak Springs area late on June 29th, as the Oak Ridge Fire ravaged the area for the second night. The high winds are pushing the Oak Ridge Fire toward the St. Michael's community, said Navajo President Boo Nygren. The community has been put on SET status, which means families should be prepared to leave at a moment's notice. On the morning of June 30th, the Southwest Area Rocky Gilbert Operations Section Chief, a coordinated group of federal and state wildfire agencies, assumed command of the Oak Ridge Fire and the Incident Command Center. They confirmed the fire grew to 6,292 acres from 1,800 the previous day. A total of 420 personnel were assigned to the fire. Gilbert explained that strong winds have been a major factor driving the fire's growth. The concerns that we have today, the winds have been causing problems, said Gilbert. As the sun goes down, the wind is supposed to switch. They're going to have gusts of up to 20 to 30 miles per hour until 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. The Oak Ridge Fire, which Navajo Nation police say was sparked by wood haulers June 28th, quickly grew in size, threatening more homes, utility lines, and gas infrastructure. During a June 29th evening briefing, Rex Cons, Deputy General Manager of the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority, informed officials that a 115 kV power line running through the fire zone had to be shut down. He said Navajo communities, including Birdside, Clagato, Chinle, and Ganado, are being powered through rerouted sources, which has created additional challenges for maintaining stable electricity. NTUA, the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority, is the only utility company that services a majority, if not all, of the Navajo Nation. We are asking everyone to conserve power, Kantz warned, adding the backup power source is at risk of overloading. If that happens, power to non-essential business services may need to be shut off until the fire is under control. What we are worried about is, it's summertime, and air conditioners use a lot of power. Since the fire began, a major concern has been the safety of the El Paso Natural Gas Plant, located near the evacuated communities of Hunters Point and Oak Springs. In his latest update, Navajo Nation President Boo Nygren stated that in Oak Springs, the Go evacuation order applies to residents living west of mile marker 12 on Navajo Route 12 up to the El Paso gas station. Residents north of the station remain in a SET evacuation status. There is significant danger in this area, and residents need to begin relocating to a shelter or with families and friends outside the affected zone, Nygren said. Governor Katie Hobbs said on social media that her administration was actively monitoring the Oak Ridge Fire. We are in communication with both Apache County and Navajo Nation, and will work with them to keep Arizonans safe, Hobbs posted on X.com, formerly Twitter. I'm thankful to the first responders on the ground, and am keeping the entire community in my thoughts as they work to combat the fire. Navajo Nation orders Stage 2 fire restrictions. On the second day of the fire, the Commission on Emergency Management declared a state of emergency due to the Oak Ridge Fire, requesting additional Navajo Nation resources to address both current and potential wildfire impacts. Fire restrictions were also increased from Stage 1 to Stage 2, with Nigrin signing off on the declarations. Stage 2 fire restrictions prohibited all open flames, including campfires and charcoal use, even in designated recreation areas. Smoking was only allowed inside enclosed vehicles or buildings. The use of firearms, air rifles, and exploding targets was banned outside of lawful hunting. Additionally, under Stage 2 fire restrictions, operating chainsaws or other internal combustion engines between 10 a.m. and 8 p.m., as well as welding or using open flame torches, was strictly prohibited. During the briefing, the Apache County Sheriff's Office stated that if deputies or officers spot anyone transporting wood during these restricted hours, they were authorized to stop the individual, seize the wood, and deliver it to the St. Michael's Chapter House for distribution to elders during the winter. The state of emergency addressed the severity of the Oak Ridge Fire, ongoing regional drought conditions, and the existing Navajo Nation fire restriction. According to the declaration, Navajo Nation will activate available emergency resources, including funding for personnel, equipment, and other necessary support to restore and sustain critical community infrastructure. All Navajo Nation divisions, departments, programs, and chapters are directed to initiate emergency response coordination, allocate resources, and implement response measures in collaboration with federal, state, and tribal partners to meet the needs of affected communities. The Commission on Emergency Management, in unified coordination with our nation's emergency response agencies and local leadership, has declared this emergency to prioritize the safety and well-being of our communities impacted by the Oak Ridge Fire. This declaration enables critical resources and operational support to be activated immediately, said CEM Chair Marcolo Roanhorse. We express deep appreciation to the firefighters, law enforcement, emergency personnel, and volunteers working on the front lines. As a commission, we stand ready to support our nation through this challenging time with diligence, compassion, and an unwavering commitment to public safety. Evacuation shelter designated, donations requested. For the past 2 days, the official evacuation shelter was available at the B. Holdzill, meaning Stronghold, Fighting Scouts Events Center in Fort Defiance, home to Window Rock High School and Sushuti Medical Center. As of noon on June 29, 15 families were staying at the shelter. It remained unclear how many more sought refuge there after evacuation orders were elevated to go later that evening. The event center was also serving as a donation drop-off site. Items requested during the briefing included children's pull-ups, sizes 4T and 5T, kids' shoes, sizes 8, 10, 11, men's shirts, XL and 2X, pillows, baby wipes, toiletries, personal hygiene products, towels, non-perishable food items, and washcloths. Also requested were clean kennels. Another concern was the safety of animals and pets. To help, the Division of Dene Education in Window Rock offered space for evacuees to stay with their pets, but some individuals chose to remain in their vehicles with their animals rather than shelter inside the events center. Animal control will also be housed there in the facility, and free vaccination for cats and dogs will be provided for evacuees' pets. The owner and pet must remain on site. Cots and dog and cat food are available. Navajo Nation Council Delegate Dr. Andy Nez, who represents the communities of Fort Defiance, Sawmill, Crystal, and Red Lake, said during the briefing that he was contacted by veterinarians who volunteered to assist evacuees' pets experiencing smoke inhalation and other related health issues, and they are located at the Division of Dene Education. Nigrin urged the public to be cautious of GoFundMe pages claiming to raise money for the fire, noting that the Navajo Nation does not have an official fundraiser for it. The call center for services and information related to the Oak Ridge Fire is 505-422-7382. The Navajo Nation Fairgrounds is available for evacuated livestock. Contact 928-270-8062 or 928-270-2254 to coordinate drop-off. You are listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Neil Kelly, and we'll continue with the news. The next article is titled, Tempe Approves Controversial Special Events Permit Rules After Hours of Protest, by Lauren DeYoung, Arizona Republic. Tempe residents, for hours, accused their city leaders to their faces of deceitful tactics and discrimination in pushing controversial changes to special event permits, the city council approved them anyway. The ordinance, which the city said aims to provide greater clarity, consistency, and fairness to how the public spaces are used, prompted outrage from residents who staged a protest before the meeting and legal experts beyond. Critics said it was a violation of First Amendment rights of speech, assembly, and religion. Supporters called it a necessary change to feel safe in their own neighborhoods. Residents, frustrated and angry, have reported an uptick in the presence of unhoused people in local parks. They complain about crime, drugs, sex, and blight, where the children live and play. But the opposition dominated public comments before the council acted July 1st. Despite the nearly 100 speakers against the proposed changes, the council voted unanimously to approve the renewed ordinance. The decision was met with loud and immediate objections from residents in the packed chamber. "This is not about discrimination," said Tempe Mayor Corey Woods, as the council meeting ran into the early morning hours of July 2nd. "It's about the ability to create a different process with multiple tiers to clearly separate people who are doing large-scale events." What are the changes to Tempe's changed public events rules? The changes update a city ordinance on the books since 1967 that requires those holding public gatherings or special events on city property to apply for permits. In a flyer passed out at the July 1st meeting, the city said that any activity or event requiring additional city review beyond that of a park use permit of a reservation will need to have a special events permit. These may include city services related to public safety, road closures, or a temporary change of the designated land use. City employees began revising the rules after questions arose about what types of activities should be considered special events, and after homeless rights activists claimed the city was unfairly targeting them. The special events permit could cost between $150 and $3,500, depending on permit and rental fees, according to the city. The city also introduced different types of permits, such as a limited park use activity permit that will cost $8 to $25. Fees would be waived for HOAs, neighborhood groups, and meet-up and leave events, where event attendees don't need exclusive use of a park. City Attorney Eric Anderson said that if a person were to get a non-special events permit, such as a limited park use permit or a Ramada reservation, they would not be required to apply for a special events permit. One of the most contentious pieces of the ordinance revolved around a 30-person threshold for requiring a special events permit. But the city defended the policy, noting that some cities in Arizona require a permit for 75 or more people, while others do it for 10. The permit requirement would also apply to events fewer than 30 people if they involve amplified sound or selling merchandise, or if the city thinks the activity would create adverse impacts on the area or necessitate city resources to maintain health, safety, and welfare. The city emphasized spontaneous protests, protected under the First Amendment and prompted by current affairs, do not require a special events permit. Organizers would need to coordinate with the Tempe Police Department as far in advance as possible. Anderson, though, said repeated weekly protests concerned with the same topic could eventually be considered no longer spontaneous and require a permit. That would be up to the discretion of the police department, he said. If you feed them, they will come. Supporters of the ordinance changes said that the problem prompting the updates lied in allowing people to host events providing food to the unhoused population in public parks. They said the ordinance in its newly approved form would stop those events, though they were sympathetic to those experiencing homelessness. Tony and Dave Powell, who live in the Cavalier Hills neighborhood, said they frequently find people holding up in the alleyway behind their house after picnics, leaving behind human waste, needles, and garbage. Their story was one of a handful shared at the July 1st council meeting that shared a common theme: an influx of unhoused people hang out after picnics in their neighborhoods, causing residents to feel unsafe. "I believe that if you feed them, they will come, no matter where it's taking place," said Kim Gaffney Loza, a 72-year-old North Tempe resident. "There has to be better solutions than giving service-resistant people a way to stay living in unhealthy and destructive ways on our streets, in our parks, and in our preserves." Councilmember Bredetta Hodge and Vice Mayor Doreen Garland said that the council received hundreds of emails voicing favor for the ordinance, but those who sent me emails were afraid of being harassed if they spoke at the council meeting. "You represent the minority," Hodge told about the 30-person crowd that remained at the council chambers at 1 a.m. Tempe protesters, parks, not permits. In 105-degree heat Tuesday evening, almost 100 people gathered before the July 1st City Council meeting to protest passing the updated ordinance. A quarter of protesters wore black shirts that read, "Parks, not permits, are for the people." Signs read, "Parks are for the people," and "Hands off our First Amendment rights." At the council meeting, more than 70 people, ranging from freshly graduated high school seniors to senior citizens, spoke to object the updates during a more than four-hour public comment period in a full council chamber. The meeting ran from 6 p.m. July 1st into the early morning hours of July 2nd. Critics of the permit updates claimed it was overly burdensome and ripe for government overreach that they said blatantly infringe on people's First Amendment rights. In this case, freedom of speech still exists if you are extremely wealthy. You get it approved by the government, and you work with the police, said Ori Brown, 18, a recent high school graduate. In what world would the government give the go-ahead for more attention to be drawn to the system's flaws or their mistakes? First Amendment scholars said municipalities are generally allowed to require permits for large events because public conduct creates questions about public safety. Though, concerns about safety have to balance against the government not suppressing unfavorable expression. Concerned speakers said the changes give too much discretion to non-elected city employees to arbitrarily deny applications, or worse, discriminate against applicants. They said their fears of discrimination or selective enforcement weren't hypothetical. They pointed to Tempe's enforcement of the existing permit ordinance against homeless rights activist Austin Davis, who was told, years after establishing his picnics, that the city required him to get a permit. He applied, but after he refused to pause the picnics during the 60-day application process, Tempe rejected it. In a public statement explaining the rejection, the city pointed to Davis' repeated defiance. However, Tempe cited a different reasons in court records filed after Davis and other residents sued the city in April. Tempe attorneys said the rejection was because Austin's application was incomplete. Davis, 24, disputed this claim in an interview with the Republic. But the ordinance doesn't just affect charitable aid activities, like events that feed the unhoused in Tempe parks. It also impacts community events. People argued that they already pay taxes to have access to the parks and keep them maintained, so a permit to use them shouldn't be required. Others said the current process to get a permit was convoluted and fraught with a lack of communication. The new permit wouldn't be any better, said Finn Howe, 22, who said he tried and failed to coordinate music events with the city when he was the president of student organization AMP at Arizona State University. Still, others criticized the lack of public input in the permit language, pointing to the fact that there was no public session to discuss the changes before it was introduced June 5th. They accused the council of rushing the ordinance updates and subjecting residents to something they had no hand in crafting. "You wanted this to fly under the radar," said Tempe resident Diane Melrose. The city said staff had been working on updates since September 2024, but that a lawsuit from Davis and other advocates in April sped up the process. Holly Robertson, who organizes runs through Tempe Parks, said despite her opposition to the ordinance and adverse effect on her run groups, she will comply with filling out the applications. She estimated she will have to fill out 156 permit applications for the latter half of 2025. "I hope you are ready to do some paperwork," she told the city council. We move on now to USA Today, and the first article is titled, "Diddy Acquitted on Top Charge in Sex Crimes Trial, Split Verdict from Jury," by Kimmy Robinson, Patrick Ryan, and Aisha Bagchi, USA Today. New York. A jury acquitted Sean Diddy Combs on the top charges and convicted of a lesser sex crimes charge after nearly 2 months of his federal trial. A 12-person jury delivered a bombshell split decision July 2nd in Combs' case, which started May 5th in Manhattan federal court. Jurors found Combs guilty of two counts of transportation to engage in prostitution, but acquitted him on the top charge of racketeering and both sex trafficking counts. Combs' trial was among the most noteworthy of the Me Too era, following explosive cases against disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein, R&B singer R. Kelly, and A-list actors Kevin Spacey and Johnny Depp. Combs, who has charged with two counts of sex trafficking, two counts of transportation to engage in prostitution, and one count of racketeering for leading what prosecutors alleged was a criminal organization over two decades, has long maintained his innocence. He previously pleaded not guilty to all charges. Combs' case proved was particularly challenging, wading into the murky, gray areas of consent and coercion, celebrity, complex workplace dynamics, and the myriad ways that people cope with trauma. His conviction centers on the transportation of two former girlfriends, Cassandra Cassie Ventura Fine and Anonymous Jane, as well as sex workers for the intent of prostitution. He faces a maximum of 20 years in prison, as each count carries a maximum of 10 years. Combs has been incarcerated at Brooklyn's Metropolitan Detention Center since he was arrested on September 16. Prosecutor Maureen Comey opposed the defense's request for Combs to be released immediately following the verdict. "There is serious, serious conduct here that will mandate a lengthy period of incarceration," she said. How long did he be in prison? Combs faced a maximum sentence of life in prison for the racketeering charge. Sex trafficking has a 15-year mandatory minimum and a maximum of life in prison. Transportation to engage in prostitution carries a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison. Combs' verdict comes a year and a half after allegations of sexual assault and trafficking started mounting against the embattled music mogul following a bombshell lawsuit from his former girlfriend of a decade, Cassandra Cassie Ventura Fine, over alleged trafficking, sexual assault, and abuse. The two amicably settled the lawsuit one day later for $20 million, but his team has claimed her legal action kicked off the criminal investigation into the Bad Boy Records founder's alleged behavior. Federal prosecutors claimed Combs led a criminal enterprise that operated on sex trafficking, kidnapping, drug offenses, and forced labor, among other crimes. Combs leveraged his wealth and celebrity status to fulfill his sexual desires in a recurrent and widely known pattern of abuse, investigators alleged. The Grammy-winning rapper and producer, who once reigned with his A-list frequented white parties, has also staunchly denied allegations brought forward in approximately 80 sexual assault lawsuits, which detail alleged incidents dating back to the 1990s. What is the Mann Act? The verdict is seen as a significant victory for Combs. The two charges on which he was convicted involve violations of the Mann Act in transporting Ventura Fine and Jane, his two former girlfriends. Ventura Fine and Jane both testified in court that Combs physically abused and controlled them and had them participate in marathon drug-fueled sexual encounters with male escorts. Those sessions, dubbed freak-offs, often involved travel across state and even international boundaries. The Mann Act, also known as the White Slave Traffic Act of 1910, is a federal law that prohibits the interstate or foreign transportation of individuals for prostitution or other immoral activities. What happened in the Diddy trial? Among the more than 30 witnesses in the trial were well-known stars, such as ex-girlfriend Ventura Fine, Scott Mescudi, a.k.a. Kid Cudi, and former Danity Kane singer Don Richard. Ye, formerly known as Kanye West, also made a brief appearance to listen to some testimony on June 13. In a long stretch of testimony from May 13 to 16, a 9 months pregnant Ventura Fine laid bare the raw details of her complicated decade-long relationship with Combs. She emotionally opened up about her participation in his alleged sexual performances that were labeled freak-offs, the physical and emotional abuse she said she faced, and the drug addiction she developed after using various substances in part to cope with the freak-offs. She also detailed alleged repeated physical abuse, which was captured in photographs shared with jurors. Combs' ex-employees also testified about Combs' alleged pattern of physical and sexual abuse, with a witness list that included former personal assistant and Sean John marketing director Capricorn Clark, an ex-personal assistant and Revolt director of development who went by Mia, former stylist Deontay Nash, and former CFO Derek Ferguson. The longest stretch of testimony was from an anonymous former partner to Combs, who used the pseudonym Jane. The two were romantically involved from 2021 to 2024, a time during which Combs was openly dating other women. Over 6 days, Jane shared all the ways Combs allegedly pressured her to do sexual performances, namely so-called hotel nights, with sex workers that could last days. That disgusted her by leveraging his control over her finances, convincing her to take drugs, and taking advantage of her desire for his approval. Like Ventura Fine, Jane also vividly described Combs' alleged abuse. In one episode, she said, he'd kicked, punched, dragged her before coercing her into performing sex acts with an escort. Despite this, Jane said on the stand, I just prayed for his continual healing and I pray for peace for him. Ahead of closing arguments on June 26th to 27th, both sides rested their cases on June 24th. Combs' lawyers rested their case in less than half an hour and did not call any witnesses. Ventura Fine and Jane both dated Combs for many years, and his attorneys attempted to paint their numerous loving text messages as evidence that freak-offs were entirely consensual. Mia was similarly affected as she posted publicly about Combs on social media, despite alleging that her former boss sexually assaulted her multiple times during her employment. Throughout the trial, prosecutors argued that these women merely tried to stay in Combs' good graces as a survival tactic, as he allegedly threatened to destroy their careers, livelihoods, and reputations. In the government's rebuttal, Prosecutor Comey explained the impossible task of trying to untangle love and abuse. For victims, finding meaning and happiness in trauma does not mean the trauma never happened, Comey said. It's healing. Diddy trial, inside the media circus. Combs' trial ignited a ferocious media circus over the last 2 months. Around the clock, social media influencers flooded the courtyard of the Daniel Patrick Moynihan United States Courthouse in Lower Manhattan, just blocks away from the Brooklyn Bridge. The insatiable content creators, several of whom wore Free Puff and Free Diddy t-shirts and ball caps, often sparred with each other and courthouse security guards as they bellowed into their smartphone screens, recounting to their followers the most salacious details of the case, some of them true, many of them not entirely. Their antics reverberated inside the courtroom itself. Most journalists were stationed in palatial overflow rooms, where they watched the trial unfold in mid-sized TV screens on the 24th floor alongside members of the public. There, the behavior of Combs' supporters went largely unchecked by security, as they cackled, booed, and hissed profanities when the rapper's accusers took the stand. "Gotcha, bitch," one man yelled gleefully after Combs' attorney tripped up Brianna Bongolan, who struggled to recall the exact date that the hip-hop mogul allegedly held her over a 17-story balcony. A nearly entire overflow room burst into applause when Combs' lead lawyer, Mark Agnifilo, finished his closing arguments, employing Trumpian rhetoric as he urged jurors to listen to the real trial and not the fake trial that prosecutors presented. The attitude among reporters, meanwhile, was mainly convivial, as they bonded over the collective Stockholm syndrome of the daily courtroom tedium. The moment you walk into the courthouse, everyone is required to check their phones and laptops after waiting through snaking lines for airport-style security. Due to the technology restrictions, journalists furiously scribbled notes for 6 to 8 hours a day, sporadically darting out of the courtroom to dictate the latest news to their editors. Given the limited number of spots in the main courtroom with Combs, multiple news organizations hired line sitters, some of whom would start camping out the afternoon before to guarantee a seat inside. And as the trial trudged on for days and weeks, it attracted countless looky-loos who wanted a glimpse of the action, including law students, European tourists, and throngs of sniggering teenagers. On one particular afternoon, a family with two small children was escorted out of an overflow room by security guards, following roughly 20 minutes of them listening to highly explicit testimony about freak-offs. In one of the trial's most unforgettable moments, a middle-aged woman dressed in an MTA transit uniform was removed from the main courtroom after screaming at Diddy that everyone is laughing at him. But for the women who testified through tears and the journalists who reported through 8 weeks of often harrowing testimony, nothing about this grueling case was a laughing matter. The next article is titled, "Live Updates, House to Vote on Trump's Sweeping Tax Bill Package Again," by Bart Janssen, Riley Begin, Joey Garrison, and Sudiksha Kochi, USA Today. Washington. The House on July 2nd started debating President Donald Trump's legislative package of tax reductions and Medicaid cuts as Republican leaders determine whether they can chart a path to victory with narrow majorities in Congress. Trump has been urging lawmakers to send him the bill to sign into law by July 4th, but also acknowledged the timeline is flexible. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, and other leaders said in a joint statement they would work quickly to meet their self-imposed deadline by approving the Senate version, which Vice President J.D. Vance pushed across the finish line with a tie-breaking vote July 1st. Republicans were elected to do exactly what this bill achieves: secure the border, make tax cuts permanent, unleash American energy dominance, restore peace through strength, cut wasteful spending, and return to a government that puts Americans first, the GOP leadership statement said. But the path is narrow enough that changes are still possible. The House approved its initial version of the bill on a 215-214 vote in May. After 4 days of marathon debate and voting, the Senate approved its version in a 51-50 vote July 1st, with three Republicans voting no and Vance breaking the tie. Multiple House Republicans who supported their version of the bill, including Representatives Andy Harris of Maryland and Ralph Norman of South Carolina, said they opposed the Senate version. Harris and Norman are members of the House Freedom Caucus, which aims to cut federal spending. A wavering Republican who voted yes, Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, said the House should recognize we're not there yet and make improvements before sending it back to the Senate. Because we have two options here, right? Kill it and it's gone, Murkowski said. Here's what we know about the bill. House Freedom Caucus releases list of complaints about the tax bill. The House Freedom Caucus has released a list of failures inside the Senate's version of Trump's tax bill. The ultra-conservative group of House Republicans' key concern is the more than $650 billion that the Senate's version would add to the deficit over the House version, which passed in late May. But they're also concerned about a number of provisions they would like to see tweaked, including carve-outs for Alaska and Hawaii from food stamp cuts to deeper cuts to Biden-era clean energy incentives, according to a memo first reported by Punchbowl News. The group will be key to getting the bill across the finish line. Trump is speaking with holdouts at the White House on July 2nd. More than 100 House Democrats made a parade of futile requests to prevent any changes to Medicaid or food assistance as part of Trump's legislative package. The chief of the Congressional Black Caucus, Representative Yvette Clark, Democrat of New York, kicked off the series of requests for unanimous consent by asking to protect against any cuts to Medicaid and SNAP, the former name of the food assistance program. But the head of the Rules Committee, Representative Virginia Fox, Republican of North Carolina, refused to yield for the first few requests, which had the effect of killing them. The acting Speaker, Representative Steve Womack, Republican of Arkansas, then simply rejected each successive request. "Wow, that gambit was riveting," Fox said after the requests were completed. The House was debating a framework for voting on the Senate's version of Trump's bill. The rule called for no change to the legislation, so that House approval would send the bill to the President for his signature. The next article is titled, "Girl Who Went Overboard on Disney Dream Cruise Was Not Being Held," by Eve Chen and Nathan Diller, USA Today. Investigators are disputing rumors about a father and daughter who were rescued after going overboard on a Disney cruise ship over the weekend. The Broward County Sheriff's Office told CBS News Miami the little girl was not being held, as erroneously reported on some social media sites, following chatter about the dad placing her on the ship's railing. The sheriff's office told people, while there doesn't appear to be anything suspicious, Broward Sheriff's Office detectives are investigating the circumstances that led up to the child falling overboard. USA Today has reached out to Broward County Sheriff's Office for the latest on the investigation. In the meantime, here's what we know. What happened? The girl went overboard on Sunday, June 29th, as the Disney Dream was heading back to Fort Lauderdale, Florida from the Bahamas. The father went in after her, and both were swiftly rescued by crew members. Gene Young, a passenger on the cruise, recalled hearing an MOB, man overboard, announcement in her stateroom, seeing crew scurrying on the ship and tossing orange rings into the water, and the ship turning. A rescue boat went out to rescue the passengers, who Young said were sitting up, moving, conscious, and trying to tell everybody that they're okay on the way back. "We commend our crew members for their exceptional skills and prompt actions, which ensured the safe return of both guests to the ship within minutes," a Disney Cruise Line spokesperson told USA Today on Sunday. What's next? Investigators are still piecing together what happened. It's unclear if the findings may impact on anything on future sailings, but Disney Cruise Line said, "We are committed to the safety and well-being of our guests, and this incident highlights the effectiveness of our safety protocols." Cruisegoers have applauded crew members' rapid response. The next article is titled, "I am 96 and the picture of longevity. These are my tips for living longer and better," by Nancy K. Schlossberg, special to USA Today. "As I was leaving my doctor's office, one of the nurses commented, 'You're looking great. I look forward to your 100th birthday party.' Startled, I realized, at 96, that wasn't so far off. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the number of Americans ages 100 and older is projected to quadruple over the next 3 decades, from an estimated 101,000 in 2024 to about 422,000 in 2054. It is exciting to read about the surge of millions living into their 80s, 90s, and early hundreds. The Atlantic labels it the longevity revolution. Dr. Laura Cartinson, the director of the Stanford Center on Longevity, describes it as a long, bright future in her book, A Long, Bright Future, an action plan for a lifetime of happiness, health, and financial security. Meanwhile, Dr. Joseph Coughlin, CEO of MIT's Age Lab, has written the book, The Longevity Economy, Unlocking the World's Fastest Growing, Most Misunderstood Market. Regardless of labels, this is undeniably a period with opportunities to create new products, housing alternatives, policies, and services to meet the needs of the changing demographic. Longevity sounds great in theory, But what does this long, bright future mean in practice for you and me? At 90, I was raring to go, but then I was hospitalized with COVID-19 and pneumonia and expected to die. By 95, my energy level had plummeted. How was I going to continue being the me I had been for years, energetic, engaged, and optimistic? I found myself wondering, if I can no longer walk the way I did, give speeches with confidence, and consult with organizations the way I once did, then what can I do and how should I do it? Even with limitations, I still want to make a difference in the world. I'm not alone in these questions. Greg Kaplan, age 72, has retired several times. His first career, right after college, was exploratory, resulting in purchasing one store in an airport. That experience led him to buy the entire franchise. After 25 years, he sold his franchise and retired. Eventually, he decided to return to his hobby, carpentry, and started designing and building kitchens. Once again, he was extremely successful, even meeting his current wife on one of his jobs. After another 15 years, he realized it was really time to retire, but he kept putting it off. He is afraid he will no longer matter, that his purpose will disappear. How to look at change. The longer you live, the more transitions you will confront. Therefore, to continue living well, we need to focus on how we can manage the many unexpected transitions ahead in order to take the mystery out of change. Viewing Kaplan's life through the transition lens provides a framework for understanding and coping with any transition at any time in life for anyone. Your ability to handle them depends on where you are in the transition process. As you exit your job or relationship and begin to move to something else, you will experience what anthropologists labeled a period of liminality, an ambiguous time in between major life phases, followed eventually by establishing a new life, a new set of roles, relationships, routines, and assumptions. Right now, Kaplan, newly retired, knows he will not have another career, but is a bit at sea. Golf is important, but he says, is that all there is? The degree to which the transition changes your life. The more a transition changes your life, the more stressful it can be. Kaplan's most recent transition, retirement, changes his role from worker to retiree, his relationships with colleagues and family, routines from work to golf, and assumptions from being relevant to not feeling he matters. The strength of your coping resources. We all approach transitions with potential resources, what I call the 4S system. Your situation, is your life in general good or stressful? Self, are you an optimist or a pessimist? Are you resilient? Supports, do you have personal and institutional support that you can count on? And strategies, do you use lots of strategies flexibly? If your resources are strong, you have a better chance of handling your transition. Will you still matter? Don Bunch, former food and beverage director at the Sarasota Bay Club, a retirement community for over 300 residents, retired himself a few years ago. And that is all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Neil Kelly. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.